This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents A Study in Scarlet Women by Sherry Thomas. This book is read by Kate Redding. To the beautiful person and constant delight that is Sean. Prologue. Devonshire, England, 1886. Had anyone told the Honourable Harrington Sackville that the investigation into his death would make the name Sherlock Holmes known throughout the land, Mr. Sackville would have scoffed. He had never heard of Sherlock Holmes, but more importantly, he despised the idea of death, of his death, to be precise. Others could die as they wished. He loathed old age almost as much. That long, vile decline into helplessness, halted only by the final breath, falling like a guillotine blade. And yet his reflection in the mirror made it increasingly difficult to tell himself that he was still a young man. He remained a fit man, a handsome man, but the skin beneath his jaw sagged, deep grooves cut into the sides of his mouth, even his eyelids drooped, heavy from the passage of time. Fear hooked through him, cold and sharp. Every man was afraid of something. For him, death had long loomed as the ultimate terror, a darkness with fangs. He turned away from the mirror, and the unwelcome thoughts that always simmered these days a scant inch beneath the surface. It was summer. The glow of twilight suffused the house. From his perch on the headlands, the bay blazed with the flame of the setting sun. A hint of salt fragranced the breeze that meandered in. The top note of that perfumed air was tuberose, bulbs of which he had imported from Grasse in the south of France. But a storm was coming. Inky clouds gathered at the edge of the sky. He inhaled deeply. No. He must not let his mind wander to shadowy places. Recent weeks had been difficult, the events in London particularly distressing, but in time things would improve. He had many good years left to relish life and to laugh at death and its still distant grasp. No premonitions crossed his mind that death was to have him by morning, but have him it would. And the last laugh. 1. London. On the day Mr. Harrington Sackville met his darkness with fangs, certain parties in the know were bracing for, and eagerly anticipating, a major scandal involving the youngest member of the Holmes family. Lord Ingram Ashburton did not share in their anticipation. The idea that such a catastrophe could come to pass had haunted him for days. He did not yet know that Holmes was already doomed, but a sense of dread had been growing in him, a tumour-like weight on his lungs. He stared at the envelope on the desk before him. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, General Post Office, St. Martin's Le Grand, London. Any idiot could see the frustration that seethed with every stroke of the pen. At several places, the nib had nearly torn through the linen paper. The writing on the note next to the envelope was equally agitated. Holmes, don't. And if you must, not with Roger Shrewsbury. You will regret it relentlessly. For once in your life, listen to me. He dropped his forehead into his left palm. It would be no use. Holmes would do as Holmes pleased, carried along on that blitheness born of extraordinary ability and favourable circumstances. Until disaster strikes. You don't need to let it happen, said a voice inside him. You step in. You give Holmes what Holmes wants. And then what? Then I carry on and pretend it never happened? He stared out of the open window. His unimpeded view of the sky appeared as if seen through a lens that had been smudged with a grimy finger. A polluted blue. A fine day for London. Peals of irrepressible mirth rose from the small park below. His children's laughter. A sound that would have brought a smile to his face on any other day. He picked up his pen. "Do not do anything without first consulting me again. Please." Was he acquiescing? Was he jettisoning all caution and all principle as well? He sealed the unsigned letter in the envelope and walked out of his book-lined study, envelope in pocket. He was scheduled to give an archaeological lecture in the evening, but first he wanted to spend some time with his daughter and son, rambunctious children at the peak of their happy innocence. After that he would decide whether to post the letter or to consign it to the fire like the dozen others that had preceded it. The front door opened, and in came his wife. "Afternoon, madam," he said politely.
"My lord."
She nodded, a strange little smile on her face.
"I see you have not heard about what happened to your favourite lady."
"My favourite lady is my daughter. Is anything the matter with her?"
He kept his voice cool, but he couldn't stop the hair on the back of his neck from standing up. Lady Ingram was not talking about their child.
"Lucinda is well. I refer to..."
Her lips curled with disdain.
"I refer to Holmes.
Your Holmes."
"How dare you humiliate me this way?"
Mrs. Shrewsbury rained down blows on her husband.
"How dare you?"
The painted French fan, folded up, made for a surprisingly potent weapon, a cross between a bolt of silk and a police baton. Roger Shrewsbury whimpered.
He didn't understand the way her mind worked. Very well, he had committed an unforgivable error.
The night before he'd been so drunk he mistook his wife for Mimi, his mistress, and told the wife what he was going to do this afternoon with Charlotte Holmes. But if Mrs. Shrewsbury hadn't wanted him to deflower Miss Holmes, why hadn't she smacked him then and there and forbidden him to do anything of the sort? Or she could have gone round to Miss Holmes's and slapped her for not having a higher regard for her hymen. Instead, she had mustered a regiment of sisters, cousins, and friends, set his mother at the helm of the entire enterprise, and stormed the Bastille just as he settled into Miss Holmes. So how could she accuse him of humiliating her when she was the one who had made sure that a good dozen other women saw her husband in flagrante delicto? He knew better than to give voice to his thoughts. After 26 years as Lady Shrewsbury's son, and 3 as Anne Shrewsbury's husband, he'd learned that he was always wrong. The less he said, the better. The missus continued to hit him. He wrapped his arms around his head, made himself as small as possible, and tried to disappear into a nice memory, a time and a place in which he wasn't a bounder 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Lady Shrewsbury frowned mightily at the young woman who sat opposite her in the brougham. Charlotte Holmes was still, her face pale but composed. Eerily composed, given she was now ruined beyond repair. So composed that Lady Shrewsbury, who had been prepared for any amount of hysterical sobbing and frantic pleas, was beginning to feel rattled, a sensation she hadn't experienced in years. Lady Shrewsbury had been the one to throw a sheet over the girl. She had then ordered her son to go home with his wife, and the rest of the women to disperse. Miss Holmes had not trembled in a corner, her hands over her face, nor had she stared numbly at the floor. Instead, she had watched the goings-on as if she were a mere bystander, one whose own fate had not in the least taken an unthinkable turn. As Roger was shoved out by his wife, Miss Holmes glanced at him, without anger, loathing, or any reflection of his helplessness. It had been a sympathetic and apologetic look, the kind the ringleader of a gang of unruly children might give to one of her followers after she had got the latter into unlimited trouble. Lady Shrewsbury had fully expected this bravado to disintegrate once the others had gone. She was famous for her sternness. Roger, whenever he found himself alone with her, perspired even when she hadn't planned to inquire into what he had been doing with himself of late. But her formidableness had no effect on Charlotte Holmes. After the gaggle of eyewitnesses departed to spread the salacious story in drawing rooms all over London, Miss Holmes, instead of dissolving into tears, dressed and ordered a considerable tea service. Then, under Lady Shrewsbury's increasingly incredulous gaze, she proceeded to polish off a plate of plum cake, a plate of cherry tartlets, and a plate of sardines and toast, all without saying a single word or even acknowledging Lady Shrewsbury's presence. Lady Shrewsbury controlled her vexation. Silence was one of her greatest weapons, and she would not be goaded into abandoning that strategic advantage. Alas, her magnificent silence had no effect on Charlotte Holmes, who dined as if she were a queen, and Lady Shrewsbury a lowly lackey, not worthy of even a spare glance. When the girl was ready to leave, she simply walked out, forcing Lady Shrewsbury to catch up. Again, as if she weren't a strict moral guardian escorting a fallen woman to her consequences, but a simple-minded maid scampering behind her mistress. The silence continued in the brougham. Miss Holmes studied the carriages that clogged the street, shiny lacquered town coaches jostling for space amidst long queues of hansom cabs. From time to time her gaze fell on Lady Shrewsbury, and Lady Shrewsbury had the distinct sensation that of the two of them, Miss Holmes considered Lady Shrewsbury the far stranger specimen. "Have you nothing to say for yourself?" she snapped, unable to stand the silence another second. "For myself, no," Charlotte Holmes said softly. "But I hope you will not be too harsh on Roger. He is not to blame for this." Inspector Robert Treddles, of the Metropolitan Police, always enjoyed an outing to Burlington House, especially to attend Lord Ingram's lectures. They had met via a shared ardour for archaeology. Lord Ingram had sponsored Treddles's entry into the London Society of Antiquaries, in fact. But this evening, his friend was not himself. To the casual observer, his lordship would seem to command the meeting room, thorough in his knowledge, eloquent in his presentation, and deft with a touch of dry humour. His comparison of the ancient family strife caused by variation in size and ornateness of each member's jewelled brooches with the modern jealousy aroused by the handsomeness of a sibling's new brougham drew peals of laughter from the audience. To Inspector Treddles, however, Lord Ingram's delivery had little of its usual élan. It was a struggle. A futile struggle, moreover. Sisyphus, pushing that enormous boulder up the hill, knowing that it would roll away from him near the top, condemning him to start all over again, ad infinitum. What could be the matter? Lord Ingram was the scion of a ducal family, an old Etonian, and one of the finest polo players in the world. Of course Inspector Treddles knew that no one's existence was perfect behind closed doors, but whatever turbulence Lord Ingram navigated in his private life had never before been made visible in his public demeanour. After the lecture, after the throng of admirers had dispersed, the two men met in a book-lined nook of the Society's soaring library.
"I'd hoped we could dine together, Inspector," said Lord Ingram. "But I'm afraid I must take leave of you very soon."
Treddles was both disappointed and relieved. He didn't think he would be able to offer Lord Ingram much consolation in the latter's current state.
"I hope your family is well," he said.
"They are, thank you. I'm obliged to pay a call on short notice. That is all."
Lord Ingram's words were calm, yet there was a hollowness to his tone.
"I trust we shall have the pleasure of a more leisurely meeting in the not-too-distant future."
"Certainly, my lord."
Inspector Treddles did not mean to delay his friend, but at that moment he remembered his other purpose for being at Burlington House this evening.
"If it isn't too much trouble, sir, may I ask you to convey a note to Holmes? I'm most grateful for his assistance on the Arkwright case, and wrote a few lines to that effect."
"I am afraid that would be impossible."
Inspector Treddles almost took a step back at his friend's expression, a flare of anger that bordered on wrath.
"I understand that you are engaged this evening, my lord," Treddles explained hesitantly. "My note requires no haste, and needs be relayed only at your lordship's convenience."
"I didn't make myself clear," said Lord Ingram.
All hints of rage had left his countenance. His eyes were blank, the set of his jaw hard.
"I can't, nor can anyone else, convey any notes to Holmes. Not any more. I don't. That is," Treddles stuttered. "Has something terrible happened?"
Lord Ingram's jaw worked.
"Yes, something terrible."
"When?"
"Today."
Inspector Treddles blinked.
Is Holmes still alive?"
"Yes, thank goodness. Then we haven't lost him completely."
"But we have,"
said Lord Ingram, slowly, inexorably.
"Holmes may be alive, but the fact remains that Holmes is now completely beyond my reach."
Treddles's confusion burgeoned further, but he understood that no more details would be forthcoming.
"I'm exceedingly sorry to hear that."
"As am I, to be the bearer of such news."
Lord Ingram's voice was low, almost inaudible. Treddles left Burlington House in a daze, hounded by dozens of unhappy conjectures. Had Holmes leaped from a perilous height armed with nothing but an unreliable parachute? Had he been conducting explosive experiments at home? Or had his brilliant but restless mind driven him to seduce the wrong woman, culminating in an illegal duel and a bullet lodged somewhere debilitating but not instantly lethal? What had happened to the elusive and extraordinary Sherlock Holmes? Such a tragedy, such a waste, such a shame. 2.
"The shame! Oh, the shame!"
Lady Holmes screeched. From her crouched position before the parlour door keyhole, Livia Holmes glared at the young maid peeking around the corner.
"Back to your duties," she mouthed.
The girl fled, but not before giggling audibly. Did no one understand the concept of privacy any more? If there was any spying to be done in the midst of a reputation-melting scandal, it ought to be left to a member of the family. Livia returned her attention to the Sturm und Drang in the parlour. Her view through the keyhole was blocked by her mother's skirt, a ghastly mound of heliotrope silk that shook with Lady Holmes's outrage.
"How many times have I told you, Sir Henry, that your indulgence of the girl would prove to be her undoing? How many times have I said that she ought to have been wed years ago? Did you listen? No! No one heeded me when I warned that letting her reject perfectly suitable gentlemen one after another would only serve to make her unfit for marriage and motherhood.
Her mighty bustle oscillated from side to side as she lurched forward. She lifted her arm and brought down her hand. An explosive thwack reverberated. Livia flinched. She and Charlotte, the recipient of this resounding slap, had once discussed their mother's talents, or lack thereof. Livia was of the view that a segment of the population was inherently middling. Charlotte, of a more charitable bent of mind, believed that even those who appeared incurably undistinguished must possess some hidden skills or aptitudes. Livia, not convinced, had brought up Lady Holmes as an example of utter mediocrity, a person who was unremarkable in every observable trait. Charlotte had countered, "But she has an extraordinary technique at slapping. The backhand, especially." Now Lady Holmes produced just that, a dramatic backhand, the force of which wobbled the lace trimmings on her skirt.
"The worst has happened. No one will marry her, and she can never show her face in society again."
It was the 11th time she had spat out these lines this evening. Livia's neck hurt from the strain of crouching so long before the keyhole. How many more iterations before Charlotte would be allowed to escape to her own room?
"You haven't only caused your own ruin, Charlotte. You have also made us laughingstocks the rest of our lives."
Lady Holmes was still ploughing through the remainder of her tirade, though her voice was becoming hoarse.
"You have perpetrated a crime against Livia's chances at a decent marriage. If Henrietta hadn't already secured her Mr. Cumberland, we would have nothing but a pathel of spinster daughters."
The contempt in Lady Holmes's voice. Spinster daughters might as well be thieving whores. Livia lived with that scorn daily. A woman of 27, 8 seasons under her belt, and no marital prospects whatsoever. Still, she winced. If history was any indication, Lady Holmes would storm toward where her husband sat and berate him some more. Then the entire diatribe would begin again. Lumbering bustle in tow, Lady Holmes marched on, clearing the line of sight from the keyhole to Charlotte. It never failed to astonish Livia that, after having known Charlotte all her life, sometimes she was still surprised by her sister's appearance, especially at moments like these. Well, there had never before been a moment quite like this, to be sure. But Charlotte had been dumbfounding her family for as long as Livia could remember. When Livia was 6 and Charlotte 4, one cold but clear Saturday afternoon on a family stroll around the village green, they'd come across a drawing that had been pinned to the notice board. There were 4 images on the piece of paper: a well, a horseshoe, the Virgin, and a kitten that was only half the size as the other images, a round, quizzical head floating on the top half of the paper. Lady Holmes had sniffed. "How strange."
"Rather interesting, I should think," replied her husband.
"But what is it?"
asked Henrietta, the eldest of the Holmes girls, her voice high-pitched and whiny.
"It's a message, of course," Livia told her impatiently. "Must be something about the children's Christmas party." "What about that party? I don't see how that can be."
How anyone could live to be 10 years old and still remain so thick, Livia had no idea.
"The Virgin gave birth to baby Jesus at Christmas. The other drawings are games that will be there."
Henrietta looked doubtful.
"Kind of games?"
Before Livia could enumerate her guesses, Charlotte said, loudly and clearly.
It isn't about games. It's a proposal.
All attention immediately turned to her. Charlotte did not speak. In fact, their mother had been fretting for some time that Charlotte might turn out to be the same as Bernardine, the second oldest Holmes girl. At 9, Bernardine was no longer taken on family outings. She'd become too disconcerting. A lovely child who paid no attention to anyone or anything. If she had any thoughts at all, she never shared them with a single person. Charlotte, with her blonde ringlets and big blue eyes, resembled Bernardine almost exactly. But whereas Bernardine was rail thin, nothing cook made ever agreed with her. Charlotte was a roly-poly dumpling, her cheeks full, her limbs round, her hands adorably chubby. A cherubic girl, one who was as silent as the small hours of the night. She nodded, shook her head, and pointed if necessary. Cook insisted that one time in answer to the question, "How many pieces of apple fritter do you want, Miss Charlotte?" the girl had given a beautifully enunciated 12. But no one else had ever heard her say so much as Mama. One time Livia had overheard Lady Holmes weep about her family being cursed.
"Not only can I not have sons, but half my daughters are imbeciles."
Livia had come away feeling both relieved that she herself wasn't an imbecile, and heartbroken that Charlotte, whom she found darling and hilarious, she never failed to smile at the sight of Charlotte attacking her food, might someday become as unreachable as Bernardine. But now, Charlotte had spoken her first full sentences. Livia would have been indignant had anyone else corrected her so unceremoniously. But Charlotte had spoken, and Livia had, no, not butterflies, but a whole stampeding herd of wildebeest in her stomach. With everyone else still dumbstruck, she shook Charlotte's mitten-clad hand, which she held in her own, and asked,
"Do you mean a proposal of marriage, Charlotte?"
"Don't be ridiculous, Livia," Lady Holmes scoffed. "She doesn't know what that is."
"Yes, a proposal of marriage, Mama," Charlotte answered. "I know what that is. It is when a gentleman asks a lady to become his wife."
Again, stunned silence all around. Sir Henry got down on one knee, a feverish gleam in his eyes. "Charlotte, my dear, why do you say these images constitute a proposal of marriage?" Charlotte cast a critical eye at the picture, her expression amusingly grown up.
"It isn't a very good one, is it?"
"Maybe not, Poppet. But why do you say it's a proposal in the first place?"
"Because it says, 'Will you marry me?' Actually, it says, 'Will you marry me?'"
"I can see a well. And I can see that the horseshoe opens up and looks like a U. And the Virgin's name is Mary," said Sir Henry. "But how is the cat me?"
"Exactly," Henrietta joined in. "That makes no sense."
Livia would have liked to shove a snowball deep down the front of Henrietta's frock, but Charlotte didn't seem to mind.
"The cat is in the middle of a meow, but since there's only half a cat, it's half a meow, and half a meow is me."
Henrietta pouted.
"How do you know half a meow is an ow inst—"
"Henrietta, shut up." Sir Henry placed his hands on Charlotte's pink cheeks. "That is remarkable, Poppet. Absolutely remarkable."
"Are you sure?" said Lady Holmes. "She might be making things up and—"
"Lady Holmes, kindly shut up too."
"Well,"
Lady Holmes sputtered. But she wasn't as easily silenced as Henrietta. "But you must tell Charlotte that since she is able to speak, she may no longer be so rudely silent." Sir Henry sighed. "Do you hear your mother, Poppet?"
But, Papa, why should I talk when I've nothing important to say?
Sir Henry barked with laughter. Why, indeed? You're wise beyond your years, my dear Poppet, and you have my blessing to be as silent as you'd like.
This was said with a glance at Lady Holmes, the corners of whose lips turned down decidedly. With an exaggerated half-bow, Sir Henry offered his wife his arm. She flattened her lips further, but took it. Henrietta grabbed his other arm. Livia and Charlotte resumed walking hand in hand. The next day was Sunday. After the sermon, the vicar announced from the pulpit that Miss Tomlinson had made him a very happy man by consenting to be his wife. Soon, news was all over the village that those odd pictures on the notice board had been the vicar's way of proposing, as he and Miss Tomlinson were both fond of puzzles and rebuses. Sir Henry pranced around the house, looking delighted and smug. Livia was happy for Charlotte, a little jealous that she wasn't the one to decipher the message, and strangely despondent. It would take her a long time to understand that the asphyxiated feeling in her chest had nothing to do with Charlotte, but everything to do with their parents. Sir Henry disdained his wife, as Lady Holmes disdained her daughters. They weren't happy together, but Lady Holmes was the far unhappier one. It had been frightful for Livia to understand this. Her mother had seemed immensely powerful, an Olympian figure striding about her fine country house, emanating command and superiority. But she was impotent before her husband's contempt. Nor was she in the end the kind of household authority figure that Livia had first believed. What control Lady Holmes exerted was largely illusory, maintained tenuously, and with frequent outbursts of anger and violence. That extraordinary slapping technique had not come about without assiduous practice. The servants despised her, Livia barely tolerated her, and Bernardine's condition was always worse when she was near. The only one with whom she got along was Henrietta, who happily flattered and even emulated her. Once in a while, Livia came upon this domestic despot sitting by herself in a corner of the parlour, looking pale and lost. But then Lady Holmes would see her and shout at her for being a disagreeable sneak who never knew when she wasn't wanted, and Livia's sympathy would evaporate as she broiled in humiliation. She was 12 when she realized that the same could happen to her, that she too could marry a handsome, well-liked man and still be miserable. That very same week, Charlotte made her observation about Mrs. Gladwell. Mrs. Gladwell was the widow of Sir Henry's cousin, a stylish, vivacious woman in her late 30s. She lived 20 miles away and occasionally called on the Holmes household. Mrs. Holmes didn't care for her. She sniffed whenever Mrs. Gladwell's name was brought up and deemed her common, vulgar even sometimes. Sir Henry, however, always insisted that Mrs. Gladwell be made to feel welcome, since she was family. Mrs. Gladwell spent part of the year in Torquay, a balmy seaside resort. Upon her return, she would call upon the Holmes girls, gifts in tow. For that reason, even Henrietta, otherwise a reliable ally for Lady Holmes, couldn't disapprove of Mrs. Gladwell with any kind of sincerity. In the course of that particular visit, Henrietta, who loved her wardrobe, received a chic new straw boater. To Livia, who wrote copiously in her diary, Mrs. Gladwell gave a handsome journal with an image of the Devon coast on the cover and a bottle of novelty ink that was a beautiful lilac. And Charlotte, whose one true love was food, but whose diet Lady Holmes carefully watched for fear she would balloon to an unacceptable size, got a scrapbook of preserved seaweed with dozens of delicate feather-like specimens ranging from pale green to robust maroon. That evening the girls were home alone with their governess, Sir Henry and Lady Holmes having gone out to dine at Squire Holyoake's. While Miss Lawton was supervising Bernardine at her bath, Bernardine suffered from occasional seizures and could not be left alone in a tub of water. Charlotte had taken Livia by the hand and pulled her into Sir Henry's study.
"We're not supposed to be here," Livia had whispered, her heart thudding.
She liked a minor dose of the forbidden as much as the next girl. But Henrietta was home, and Henrietta lived to snitch.
"Henrietta is changing," said Charlotte. "I guess that's all right, then."
Henrietta at 16 dined with their parents when the latter were home, and otherwise alone at the big table. She loved the ritual of changing into her dinner gown, and could be counted on to spend forever coiffing her hair and trying on different petticoats until she found one that best complemented the shape of the dress.
"But why are we here? What do you want to show me?"
Charlotte lifted a paperweight from Sir Henry's desk and held it out toward Livia.
"I've seen it."
Livia, too, sometimes snooped around Sir Henry's study. "He got it from that place he went to in Norfolk on the trip with his classmates." Twice a year, Sir Henry went on a gentleman-only excursion with old boys from Harrow. He'd returned from the latest one 3 days ago, and Livia had peeked in on the paperweight when it was still sitting in a box that declared, "A gift for you from Cromer is within."
"Look closer," said Charlotte.
Charlotte was no longer the mute she'd once been, but still she didn't utter much beyond what was required, the morning vicar variety, and the occasional "how do you do" to people she was meeting for the first time. So when she did speak, Livia paid attention. She gazed down to the photographic image at the bottom of the glass paperweight, which depicted a large building, several stories tall.
"Isn't this the hotel he stayed at when he was in Cromer?"
Charlotte pulled out a postcard from the pocket of her blue frock.
"I found this in the Book of Preserved Seaweeds."
On the postcard was a near replica of the image in the paperweight. "The Imperial Hotel, Torquay," said the caption. Livia sucked in a breath. That Mrs. Gladwell had such a postcard was hardly surprising, since that was where she'd holidayed. But for Sir Henry to have come back from his trip with a keepsake smacking of Devon, when he should have been several hundred miles away on the coast of the North Sea.
"How did he get a souvenir from Torquay?"
"Either he was given one by someone who had been there, or he was there himself."
"Why did he put it in a box that said it was from Cromer?"
"Why does Henrietta lie about finding a length of ribbon in her trunk when she bought it?"
Livia's stomach rolled over. It was because Henrietta knew she was doing something she wasn't supposed to.
"But what was Papa doing in Torquay? And why didn't he take us there with him?"
Insight burst into Livia's head with the force of an explosion.
"Good gracious! He was there with Mrs. Gladwell."
Charlotte didn't appear in the least surprised. Livia realized that her sister had already come to that conclusion, and that was why she had wanted to show Livia the evidence.
"You mustn't tell Mama, Charlotte. You understand?"
"I won't say anything, but I think Mama knows. Or suspects, at least. You know she rifles through Papa's study too when he's not home."
Livia stared at Charlotte's round, pink-cheeked face, cherubic as ever. Was this why Lady Holmes so disliked Mrs. Gladwell? And dear God, did Sir Henry mean to leave this paperweight where Lady Holmes was sure to see it, and then have a postcard bearing the exact same image come into the house, something the girl who found it would probably display in her room, thereby rubbing his seaside holiday with his mistress in his wife's face? Was that what Charlotte had wanted to tell Livia?
Do you think he's in love with Mrs. Gladwell?
Livia couldn't decide which would be worse, that their father loved someone else, or that he was unfaithful to their mother with a woman he didn't even love.
No, said Charlotte decisively. Come here.
There was a box inside the bottom drawer of Sir Henry's desk, a box secured with a dark bronze, strange-looking lock, which Livia guessed to be some sort of Chinese antique. Its shape was a barrel formed by five rotating discs, which bore Chinese characters that had once been painted with gold lacquer, but had now faded almost to the point of illegibility. Livia knew about the box. She'd understood instinctively that the lock would open if she lined up the correct characters, but when she'd tried on a previous occasion with their parents out of the house, she'd become frustrated after dozens of unsuccessful attempts. Charlotte, however, peered at the lock and turned the discs one by one with great confidence.
You tried enough times to find out the correct combination?
Livia marveled.
No. Papa doesn't read Chinese any more than we do. If you look at the lock in strong light, you can see smudges of pencil marks around some of the characters. And when you line those up...
Charlotte drew back the pin, set the lock aside, and held out the now open box to Livia. The first thing Livia saw was a newspaper clipping, which announced Sir Henry's engagement to someone named Lady Amelia Drummond. Next came a wedding invitation.
But this can't be right. The wedding was on... That's the day of Mama and Papa's wedding. You don't suppose Mama is secretly Lady Amelia Drummond?
Charlotte shook her head and gestured Livia to lift the invitation. At the very bottom of the box lay a small photograph of a young Sir Henry and a handsome and very superior-looking young lady who was most certainly not Lady Holmes. Livia stared at the picture.
Did this Lady Amelia jilt Papa? And did he marry someone else on the original wedding day to spite her?
Charlotte locked the box again and put it back carefully. Then she went to the door, peered out, and beckoned Livia to follow her. Once they had ascended the stairs to their room, Livia sat on the bed, her head in her hands, and tried to cope with the day's revelations.
Do you think Mama found out that he married her on the day he was supposed to marry Lady Amelia?
Yes.
Before or after?
Charlotte thought for a minute.
After.
That made sense. Lady Holmes's parents had been respectable but short on funds. Without the means to afford a season for their daughter, they might not have kept up with the flood of matrimonial news coming out of London. Not to mention Lady Holmes wouldn't be so disillusioned if she'd known what she was getting into in the first place.
I wonder why Mama doesn't have the equivalent of a Mrs. Gladwell. Do you think she wants to?
At Charlotte's placid question, Livia bolted upright.
Have an affair? I've no idea if she wants to, but I'm sure Papa would be extremely cross if she were to.
Why?
He does it. And he doesn't seem at all ashamed about it. I can't explain it. I just know he'd be angry.
Charlotte considered this, her face as serene as that of an angel on a Christmas card.
That's not fair, is it?
Of course it's unfair, but that's how it is. I don't like it.
Neither do I. I hate it. But we have to live with it.
Charlotte was silent. Down the passage, Henrietta's door opened. The heels of her evening slippers clicked forcefully as she descended to dinner.
Must we?
Asked Charlotte. This question somehow shocked Livia more than the ones that preceded it. She tossed the postcard into the grate and set it on fire.
Yes, we must.
There's nothing else to do but to live with it.
The matter of Sir Henry's romantic liaisons and their effect on Lady Holmes wasn't mentioned again until 2 years later, when Henrietta, at 18, became engaged before the end of her first season. Shortly afterward, Livia and Charlotte met Mr. Cumberland, her fiancé. With every last ounce of her self-control, Livia managed not to roll her eyes during the encounter. Mr. Cumberland wasn't nearly as insufferable as Henrietta, but good gracious, that man was dumb as a post.
"That poor idiot," she said to Charlotte as soon as they were alone.
Charlotte opened the drawer of her nightstand and took out her contraband, a large piece of plum pound cake that she'd smuggled out of the kitchen.
"I agree,"
Livia huffed. "Anybody willing to marry Henrietta has to be an idiot." Charlotte nodded absently, her attention on the cake. Lady Holmes was unhappy that for all the restrictions placed on Charlotte's diet, the latter had not become any less tubby. Livia used to delight in the trafficking of buns and puddings for Charlotte, as much to defy her mother as to savour Charlotte's inexpressible joy as she sank her teeth into forbidden fruits. But lately Livia was beginning to be remorseful about her role as Charlotte's abettor and procurer. The prevailing fashion was unforgiving, and Charlotte was going to be awfully uncomfortable in those whale-boned, steel-ribbed corsets, the only purpose of which was to manhandle a woman's body into a wasp-waisted figure. Well, provided that someday Charlotte could be persuaded to abandon her dedication to her blue broadcloth frock, the only dress she had worn for years, remade every 18 months or so to accommodate for her growing height.
"Well, don't just assault your cake," Livia went on. "Tell me why you think Mr. Cumberland is an idiot."
It was possible to hold a minor conversation with Charlotte these days, if one was willing to prompt her at every turn. Charlotte didn't seem to mind being asked to speak, though she often volunteered to take Henrietta's shift with Bernadine. One didn't need to say anything, sitting with Bernadine. In fact, the opposite was true. The less one tried to talk to Bernadine, the less frustrating those sessions were.
"He doesn't lack for money," said Charlotte. "But the fit of his clothes is terrible. He clearly doesn't know how to choose a tailor. And he thinks one showy knot of the necktie makes up for bad shoes and trousers that are too short. Besides, his valet is robbing him blind."
"What?"
"The diamond on his stick pin is paste. Since he wouldn't have bought a paste stick pin, his valet probably sold the original and put in a cheap replica."
Livia had been half reclining on their bed. She leaped to the floor.
"Shouldn't we tell Henrietta that he employs a thief? Henrietta was the one who showed me how to tell a real diamond from paste," Charlotte said, as placid as she always was when she dropped these bombshell observations. "She knows. She'll make sure the valet's gone soon. But to knowingly accept a proposal from this moron, I almost feel sorry for Henrietta."
"Don't. He's exactly what she's been looking for. Henrietta isn't stupid. She isn't going to marry someone like Papa. She wants someone she can control, and now she has one."
Livia grimaced.
"Are we sure that he does have sufficient funds? Not like us. All appearances."
Charlotte had first pointed out, a year earlier, that cook wasn't putting the correct amount of butter in her pound cake anymore, which led to the discovery that the allowance cook had for purchasing ingredients had been significantly reduced. But it was Livia who took the audacious step of steaming open a letter for Sir Henry from his bank, and that was how they found out that the house was heavily mortgaged and their parents deep in debt. It was around the same time that Bernadine's nursemaid was let go, and the task of keeping an eye on her fell to her sisters, whose governess was also relieved of her duties, with Lady Holmes declaring that the girls were old enough to not need one any more. Livia, already disillusioned with her parents, became even more so. If they must make a mockery of their marriage, couldn't they at least be responsible stewards of their finances?
Henrietta was careful, said Charlotte. Remember when she and Mama went on that 2-day trip to visit Mama's sick aunt? Or so they said. I found punched tickets from their journey, and the destinations weren't anywhere Mama had relations. But Mr. Cumberland mentioned all those places today, locations for his family's holdings. That's what Mama and Henrietta did. They investigated those holdings on the ground to make sure they were in sound shape. Huh. I didn't give Henrietta enough credit. Henrietta has always been clever where her own interests are concerned. But she's still marrying an idiot.
Livia flopped back down on the bed.
Though I suppose it's better to marry an idiot than someone who thinks you're an idiot.
Charlotte's attention returned to her cake. Livia stared at the ceiling, swarmed by pessimistic thoughts. She was startled when Charlotte spoke again, as much by the fact that Charlotte wished to continue their conversation as by Charlotte's actual question.
"You won't marry an idiot, will you?" asked Charlotte.
"I certainly hope not," Livia answered glumly.
Or at least with my eyes open if I do. What about you?
I don't want to marry.
But how will you live? You know there won't be enough money to keep us as spinsters.
I can earn money.
If I were a boy and there were no money in the family, wouldn't I be expected to have a profession?
Yes, but you aren't a boy.
Mama will have a fit at the idea of one of her daughters working.
Mama doesn't need to agree.
Livia laughed.
You're deluding yourself if you think Papa will.
She was unsentimental about Sir Henry, since Sir Henry had no use for her. But Charlotte was his pet. He was vastly amused by her combination of great intelligence, great oddity, and great silence. He regularly took her for walks, just the two of them. He bought contraband sweets for her. And he read her his favourite poems, and was tickled that she could immediately recite them back to him.
"What makes you think he won't?" asked Charlotte.
"The same reason I think he'd fly into a rage if he found Mama having an affair. He might appear congenial, but he isn't at all liberal in his thinking. Keep that in mind."
Charlotte nodded, looking rather sadly at the empty plate before her. It was the last time Livia saw Charlotte consume such a quantity of cake, or of any comestible for that matter, in one sitting. The next few years brought a slew of unforeseen changes on Charlotte's part. For one, she began to take an active interest in her wardrobe, studying fashion plates, trying on different combinations of petticoats and stockings, accompanying Lady Holmes to browse selections of lace and feathers. By extension, she paid far greater attention to her figure and stopped eating until she couldn't swallow another bite. The day she asked for a second helping of carrots and then forewent pudding at the end of the meal, Livia drew her aside and asked whether she was ill. Charlotte shook her head. Much to Lady Holmes's relief, her youngest child also exerted a heroic effort in the direction of small talk. Instead of startling and discomforting visitors with such comments as,
"I see you no longer write in your journal,"
or,
"I'm sorry the trip to Bath wasn't as successful as you'd hoped it would be,"
she'd learned to smile, nod, and chat about the weather. This last was not accomplished without trial and error. In the beginning, she had a tendency to correct old Squire's exclamations of, "We haven't had so much rain since I was a boy in short breeches," by quoting concrete records from the parish registers, which demonstrated that there had been far greater precipitation a mere 5 years ago. It was after a fair bit of practice and no shortage of awkwardness that she at last grasped the point of all that persiflage, which was merely to avoid the silence of people having nothing to say to one another. The uncomfortable silence, in other words. But since there was no such thing as an uncomfortable silence for Charlotte, it was as difficult for her to understand as it was for a man with vertigo to master the Viennese polka. Sometimes, as Livia stood beside her, perspiring on her behalf and making every attempt to convey the correct response via telepathy, it struck her how much Charlotte resembled a foreigner who found native customs baffling and, on occasion, patently ridiculous. One time, in the middle of reading a magazine article about the possibility of life on Mars, it occurred to Livia that Charlotte was more akin to an interplanetary alien. It wasn't only the habits and conventions of the English she found perplexing, but that of all humanity. But eventually Charlotte cleared that hurdle. She not only learned the stark difference between asking after an old lady's cold versus her problem with incontinence, she became adept at navigating these formerly treacherous shoals, even though Livia could tell at times that she was herding a situation through an internal algorithm, trying to generate an appropriate response. But overall, her transformation appeared complete. The little girl who insisted on wearing the same dress year in and year out had been replaced by a young lady in ruffles and plumage. Instead of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, she now read Burke's Peerage and Cornhill Magazine. And while she never slimmed to an elegant sveltness, she retained a hint of a double chin, and the buttons of her bodice always seemed in danger of popping open. Her tendency toward plumpness worked very well with her wide eyes and rosy cheeks. She wasn't beautiful, but she was darling. People responded to her the way they would a nursery rhyme character, all grown up and come to life. Boys and young men became tongue-tied, their eyes busily darting from her pink pillowy lips to the firm rise of her breasts. Livia was half envious of this response her little sister evoked from the gentleman, and half mournful. Who was this girl swaddled in flounces, who put honey on her face and coconut oil in her hair? What had happened to the Charlotte Livia remembered, that noted odd duck, who was the only person with whom Livia felt comfortable, the only person Livia trusted? And then, the day before they were to leave for London for their first season together, Charlotte said to Livia, "I spoke with Papa today." They were walking in the fields on the outskirts of the village. The day was sunny but still cool. The countryside was a fresh, sparkling green, and Charlotte's cream-coloured dress, dainty with lace and passementerie, offered an impossibly pretty contrast against this backdrop of brightly lit nature. Livia was feeling downhearted at the likelihood that the new Charlotte would swim in proposals by the end of the season. Livia's chances on the matrimonial mart were nowhere near as favourable. She was a misanthrope. Rare was the man or woman who didn't deeply disappoint her. That was bad enough for a young lady, but to make matters even worse, she was a misanthrope who didn't know how to pretend not to be one. If Charlotte were to accept a proposal, Livia would be left all alone at home. She sighed. "What did you and Papa talk about? Do you remember the day we met Mr. Cumberland? I said I didn't want to marry." "You told Papa you don't want to marry today? Right before we are to leave for London?" "No, I spoke to him the day after we met Mr. Cumberland." Livia blinked. That would have been 5 years ago. "I told him I did not think the institution of marriage would suit me very well. I said I wished to look into other means of livelihood." "And what did he say?" "He said
that he believed I was too young to make any permanent decisions. He encouraged me to look into aspects of being a girl that I hadn't explored at the time, fashion, etc., to experience more fully the traditional path for a woman before I rejected it altogether. This sounded shockingly reasonable and wise. Livia could scarcely believe they were talking about Sir Henry. I did as he asked. As it turns out, fashion is rather enjoyable.